Hello, everybody, and good afternoon. Is this mic on? Good. My name is Peter Reiling. I think I've met mostly everybody in the room by this point, but it's my pleasure to introduce this afternoon's session, which we're calling Sustainable and Effective Social Healthcare, India's Social Entrepreneurs. My role is little more than to welcome you and to introduce Bill Hazeltine, who really needs no introduction, but probably best known as, in his role as chairman of Human Genome Sciences, his terrific work in HIV/AIDS, cancer, and genomics. And of course, Bill, I need to thank you for your sponsorship of not only this session. Sorry, I just wanted to say I want to thank Bill for his sponsorship of this session and several others that are taking place at the Institute. So without any further ado, Bill Hazeltine.
Well, thank you, Peter, and let me first thank the Aspen Institute. It's been wonderful to work with the Aspen Institute. It's very receptive to the kind of thinking that we're involved with here in this panel. I'd like to begin with sort of very broad framing of the issues as they affect us in America, because this panel is basically lessons from abroad, what we can learn from healthcare structures that are being developed other places in the world. All of us know that healthcare is a critical personal concern. We're worried about our own health. We're worried about the health of our children. We're worried about the health of our relatives. We're worried about the health of our communities. But one of the things we also know is that it is an emerging major problem for our country. I'm on the board of trustees of Brookings, and we've done 20-year projections of what the U.S. budget will look like. And the healthcare costs on any reasonable trajectory projected forward will break our budget. They are, in the words that were used this morning, unsustainable. If they're unsustainable, what will happen? What will happen is they will change, and the most likely change is we will have a degraded healthcare system for all of us. Now, my personal motive for this, and we all bring our own personal agendas to this, is as a lifelong researcher interested in translation of knowledge to human benefit. And we have created tremendous tools for helping people, for creating new medicines. But in the current environment, the attitude is new medicines and new procedures cost too much. It's the opposite of what should happen with invention. It should lower costs, it should raise costs. And I'm afraid that unless we figure out how to streamline the whole process and develop healthcare services which are cost efficient, we will all suffer. We will personally suffer, our children will suffer, and our grandchildren will suffer. And everybody in the world will suffer. I've been looking around the world the last 2 years since I've left Human Genome Sciences for examples of efficient healthcare delivery services, something that we could learn from here in the United States, something that can help poor and middle class. Everybody's familiar with what's happening in India, I think, with the Apollo system, which serves the rich. That it provides low-cost, relatively low-cost health services for us, but for the local people, it takes doctors away from treating poor and middle-class people in India, and it only serves the wealthy. I was looking for examples of efficient, cost-effective ways to deliver high-quality care, and I've been very pleased to find independent operators in Central and South India, from Hyderabad to Madurai, where people are delivering high-quality, socially effective health care targeted to the poor and middle class, which have a very important additional component in that context, which is they are self-sustaining without outside funding. Once they get up and running, they've been self-sustaining. And in many cases, in the cases you'll hear today, self-expanding. We can learn a lot from that. A number to think about, when C.K. Prahalad studied a few of these, was that they are delivering high-quality health, equivalent or better than the healthcare we provide, in specialized area like heart surgery, gastroenterology, eye surgery, at between 1/30th and 1/50th our cost. Between 1/30th and 1/50th of our cost. Is that labor? Is that land? That is not the answer. On this panel are two people who've actually built one of these systems. Unfortunately, we're going to have example of a third in a different area. They're going through a transition. The leader, one of their leaders, is quite ill. They're in a transition period right now. Otherwise, we'd have had another perspective. But let me introduce our panelists very briefly. But before I do that, let me just thank people who have been involved. First, in addition to my support of this this conference and this track, which will continue in this room right afterwards, by the way, with a 15-minute break and a more informal discussion, is the Lind Family Trust. And Michael Lind, who's sitting up front, Michael, will you stand up a minute, has joined me in helping to support this and other workshops. Secondly, we have provided you a handout. In these meetings, there's a lot to absorb. We hope you'll take this home and read it. It's got in it several different things. There's a workshop on best practices that John Michael and I ran together with the Aspen Institute and the Aspen Institute of India in Delhi last November. And you can see that there are a series of groups doing this kind of work. And some of that is summarized here in this document. I'm deeply indebted, as is John Michael, to C.K. Prahalad, who's just about the only professional economist studying this phenomenon. And he's written up some things. He's written Aravind in his book, The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid, and a few others. But he's done some other papers not yet published, which you have with his permission in this handout. One of them is called Building Ecosystems for Breakthrough Innovations. And Sachin Rao, who wrote the text for our conference, and Sachin's over here at the end, and also has been deeply involved with C.K. Prahalad's studies, and we're very grateful to him for C.K. Prahalad for allowing us to distribute these. And I think you'll find them very interesting and provide some quantitative background for some of the assertions that are being made. His studies aren't particularly in the hospital that's represented here, but on other other hospitals. To my immediate left is Dr. Soma Raju, a noted cardiology based in Hyderabad. He's from CARE Hospital. They founded a hospital, one hospital, about 10 years ago, and they'll talk a little bit about their philosophy. They now have five hospitals and I think 1,000 beds.
Yes.
And they have plans to expand into other areas of medicines and throughout India and into medical education. And they've, together with Dr. Krishna Reddy, who is also a cardiologist, I believe you're both continuing to do surgery, right?
Yeah.
As well as management. They're quite remarkable men, have built up this, I think, very fine example of this type of medicine. We're very fortunate that at the last minute, Jacqueline Novogratz from Acumen Fund has agreed to join us. Her interest is in very broad social entrepreneurship and has some interesting ways to finance it and some examples outside of this group of social entrepreneurship in medicine and how people can get real returns from their social investments. And I think that's always something that's important, and then I've introduced Dr. Sachin Rao. Later, we'll have two other people involved with the discussion. Dr. Umana is here from Columbia, a cardiologist, and Albina de Bois-Vouvray, who has helped age orphans throughout the world through her foundation, and they'll join us in this roundtable discussion. We also have Antonio Vivas from the the Inter-American Development Bank, who we're encouraging to learn what's going on so we can expand it not only in Asia but throughout South America as well. So we have two South American representatives. So themes to think about: how we can do low-cost healthcare here in the United States so we can afford our future, how we can help export it to other countries, what it means for social entrepreneurship, and self-sustainability and this new model for social activism that doesn't require continued giving from developed to underdeveloped countries or developing countries. And so there's a lot of very rich themes to explore in the time we have. So let me begin with you, Dr. Soma Raju, and talking about, I think, one of the important aspects of this, which is what is your philosophy? How did you come to think about this way of organizing delivery of health in your specialty.
Thank you, Professor Hazelton and friends. At the outset, while Professor Hazelton particularly went out of the way to say that we have something to tell you here, or America has something to learn from us, but I must admit in all humility that all our learning and all our skills, most of them, we learn in this country. And what we practice is almost similar to what happens here, and we are ever grateful to this country for making all that possible. Even today, we continue to interact and learn and then deliver what is possible in India through that help. But while we say that, we had a challenge of a different kind. Namely, there is so much available in medicine now that the developments in technology, medicine, and all varieties of medicine, namely there is drug therapy or catheter interventions or surgeries, everything improved. But the greatest challenge for us in a country like India is how to deliver them to the patients. So here, until very recently, America never faced that problem of delivery. Now I understand there is a problem of delivery, it's going to be a problem, but this problem was always there for us. Only, say, less than 8% of our population really afford what we do in our tertiary care hospitals, whether it's bypass surgery or angioplasty or in cardiology, or similar procedures in other specialties. So to make all that possible for rest of the population, not to deny care to patients, is the greatest challenge medicine faces in countries like ours. And initially we found it almost an impossible task. We started off our careers only treating a few patients here and there, and that was also limited. But as time passed on, we realized that there are some methods by which you need not turn away patients. Most of these can be delivered to most of the patients who come to us with some systems that can be evolved. But all that required, number one, the belief and passion, and not only one or two people, but a group of people have to come together. And not only doctors, nurses, but also industry, business, they have to believe in it. And small areas like what we did in Care Hospital Hyderabad, it is possible, it is deliverable. And that is the philosophy we believed in, and we almost succeeded in making a small example present to Professor Hazelton. But we haven't reached any magnitude, and we have to reach that stage now. I think Dr. Krishna Reddy, my colleague, will highlight the details of how we do this in actual practice. Is it all right, sir?
Let me point out that what he calls small is a 1,000-bed hospital for cardiology. That's not what we call small. But scalability, of course, is an issue. And one of the things that I'd like you to talk about, Dr. Reddy, is how you actually organize it. I understand that you can even do some cross-subsidization with an open-heart surgery at a cost of what's the U.S. equivalent of about between $1,500 and $2,000. So if you're a paying patient and you need a procedure, open-heart surgery, you will pay $2,000 if you can afford the full freight. Some of the procedures you do for free. How can you organize? First of all, that's almost an unbelievable number for somebody here. Yeah. And the first reaction will be, well, it's got to be wages. We don't pay anybody anymore. So how do you actually organize it to do it?
As Dr. Somaraja has mentioned, I mean, to meet the challenge, one is we try to do it in a kind of networked, integrated approach. One, we looked at the delivery system. And second, we looked at the elements and the cost and the quality. And third, we looked at how to make it accessible. I mean, that is the third challenge. Not only that we create centers of excellence, but the same quality and the same cost has to be deliverable to people who are far away from centers of excellence. So this integrated model, we try to look at as a delivery model by bringing together certain like-minded professionals. Why we thought the professionals have to generate this model is that unless professionals believe that it is possible, they contribute right from the capital planning of a hospital, wherein they exactly know what are the quality elements which they cannot afford to sacrifice for a given cost. Where at the same time, you can still build a quality hospital by restricting capital per bed. Let us say Apollo model, the cost per bed was about 30 lakhs per bed.
How much is that in dollars?
30 lakhs per bed is about 75,000.
35,000 bed. But for you, how much?
For us, it was about 5 lakhs. That is about $10,000 per bed.
That's to build a new bed.
Yeah. That was the beginning. One of the cost component that we are trying to address is in terms of the how to contain the capital cost. The second component in terms of...
Let me ask you a question. When you set up your first hospital, and it was about 10 years ago?
Yes.
How much capital was needed in dollars?
In dollars, that's about 6 crores. That is $1.5
million. $1.5
million. Yes.
Is that enough to build a whole... You didn't build a whole hospital.
Yeah, this was about a 100-bedded cardiac unit.
$1.5 million?
Yes. We took
and
a building...
where did that capital come from?
Almost 80% of the capital came from a soft funding through ICICI. That actually came through the USAID, which had given to the government of India, was being channelized through the ICICI.
Which is a commercial bank.
Commercial bank, but this soft grant was funded. It was at 1% interest per annum.
And is that the only external funding you received
today?
And today you have 5 hospitals with 1,000 beds?
Yeah, 1,000 beds, and it's about $100 million turnover right now.
So I would call that extremely efficient funding.
Yeah.
I think you'd be hard-pressed to find funding that's as efficient. How could you be so efficient? Sachin, do you have a comment here?
How do you determine the 100 beds number? How do you determine what the appropriate size is?
The size was based on our prior patient load, and because we were a large group of cardiologists and cardiac surgeons, and we actually created the cardiac facility in the state of Andhra Pradesh. So that way our group was very well known in terms of the skill set and the quality of care.
So you were already well-established.
Well-established,
in Hyderabad.
In Hyderabad, in the state also, yeah.
Why did you decide to go out on your own? What was your motive for doing that?
The motive is, we were, prior to this venture, we were working in a public institution. But any public institution, it has its own limitations. We were not able to go beyond certain governmental regulations, so we could not express our innovation there or our ideas in terms of... So what we thought is you create a similar institute. I mean, you create an institutional atmosphere where a professional feels to stay in terms of research and academics and the teaching. At the same time, you give them a life of a private facility where they have the freedom. Not only freedom, they have the financial comfort of a private practice. So you have both an institutional atmosphere as well as the financial comfort that attracts a good talented professional into the group. I mean, that was one of the key elements.
But how, if you're only charging $1,500 to $2,000 per patient, can you afford to pay a competitive salary for your doctors?
How we built it is, the professionals, we built it as like percentage of a package amount. So what we say is whatever is charged to the patient, whether it is $1,000 or $2,000 or $3,000, certain percentage of that package will go to the professional. So, in effect, the professional will look at...
It doesn't go on a fee-for-service basis. It goes as a salary?
No, this is a fee-per-service basis.
It does go on a fee-for-service basis.
It does go on a fee-per-service basis. But because of the commitment, when we take the professionals into the group, we clearly spell out that this is the commitment, that we need to make it cost-effective. So that means they have to be mentally prepared, that they have to forego their some of the professional... income for a certain segment of population, while making little higher professional income for a certain segment of population. So, in effect, what we look at it is what average professional income that they are going to get. But by creating this model, what we are able to do is attract the people from across the segment, social segments of the population, be it low income, middle income, or the high income. So in that sense, when a typical surgeon, like in US, a cardiac surgeon, will be doing about 100 cardiac surgeries per year. But with our group, the typical cardiac surgeon will do the same 100 cardiac surgeries per month.
Per month?
Per month.
So they're doing 12 times as many surgeries?
Yes.
How can they do that? They're only human, aren't they?
Yeah. No, they
you mean our surgeons are underutilized?
I think so. I mean, they're underutilized.
So they're doing, how many surgeries do you guys do in Colombia? Do you do, that's 1,200 or less
yeah.
a year?
Per surgeon.
Per surgeon?
We do about 400 per surgeon a year.
Yeah. So you guys are loafing around too.
I would challenge that.
but how can I mean, Indians are human too, right?
Yeah.
How can they do that many surgeries?
No, it's three surgeries per day. I mean, they do 6 days a week.
It's not very high.
It's not very high.
Not very high.
Yes, Sachin?
About one question about the, or rather a comment that probably you can ratify, that your doctor determines how much of subsidy every patient gets.
Yeah, we give the freedom to the professional. I mean, that is another thing which Sachin has brought out. We give the freedom to the professional that he assesses the patient whether he can afford $3,000 or $1,000, and then we suggest. Or he may not afford anything also. But we have a system of networking with certain social organizations wherein a purse to like last year, we could do about 500 children with cardiac defects free of cost to the child.
Mm-hmm. But 500 free of cost.
Yeah, 500 surgeries, children were done, and about 600 surgeries we are doing this year.
Yeah.
Thing is, we were able to network and mobilize certain social funding, either from the government or NGOs or the trustees. That way, the hospital contributes the cost price. That means we do it cost price of $1,500. The professional may be doing only 20% of what he charges normally.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the money is channelized through 3-4 funding agencies.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is a networking agency wherein we are able to do almost about 70% of the children with heart defects free of cost.
Mm. Let me ask Jacqueline a question. Jacqueline, you've been involved in social entrepreneurship for a long time through Acumen Fund, and you're well known for your work. One of the things we've heard described here is cost-efficient use of capital. How do you look at that in healthcare sectors and more generally in social entrepreneurship? I mean, this seems like an extraordinary efficient use of capital.
No doubt. And I think what we are still grappling with, I don't think that we have the answer, quite frankly, Bill, is a mix of social returns and financial returns. And so as we are more capital constrained, which we are now because we have about a $50 million pipeline and only about $10 million to fund, we've had to make decisions based on where our money will be most effective.
Would you fund these guys?
Hands down. It would be interesting. The question I would ask, and one of the things that we come to with social entrepreneurs often, and where we have this in a couple of cases, in India, interestingly, well, let me back up and get to this, but it's the question of do the entrepreneurs themselves want to scale, and what does that look like for the entrepreneurs? So it's easier for us in some cases to put together capital packages than it is sometimes for the entrepreneur, especially in longer-term family-owned enterprises, to make the decision to go to scale. So it's really it's more of a two-way street than might meet the eye. So that's one real issue where we see this is the most effective use of capital, but we can't do anything. And sometimes it's a conversation that takes 2 or 3 years. With Aravind, which I think is another really wonderful example.
One that Sachin has studied in great detail.
Which you've studied. The issue there for us is...
Aravind is an eye hospital, by the way, in Madurai, which now does something like 225,000 to 250,000 cataract surgeries a year at a cost of about $60 each and makes a lot of money and is expanding and has a goal to cover all of India.
Well,
and they do other kinds of eye services as well. So that was a reference to Aravind. We assume that most of you have read The Fortune at the Bottom of the Pyramid and know Aravind very well.
Well, and I think that what Aravind does is really push as well, what are the different factors that allow more effective health delivery, which goes back to how we would make our decisions around where we would deploy our capital, because too often people come to us with the great new technology, but there's no delivery system. And so the four factors we really look at is, how is the technology priced? How is it designed? Is it designed for poor people? Is the distribution effective enough? And are you marketing in such a way that people actually choose to use the product? And so with Aravind, and I don't know if that's what you want to talk about, and if it is, then
no,
I won't.
No, please go ahead.
So if I can just go through that level, in fact.
Sure.
On the design of the technology and the pricing, when the world price of an intraocular lens, which is the lens you use for cataract transplants, was $140, Aravind decided to create a $10 lens, which it effectively did. And it's an interesting story, again, back on capital and how we make these choices in the social entrepreneurial sector, because Big Pharma, and I know that it would be interesting to hear from you, Big Pharma came in and said, look, we'll buy this, we'll scale it, but we want to agree on a $60 price point. Well, Dr. Venkateswamy, who was the founder, said, still too expensive for people to make a dollar a day. And so the decision was made to retard scale and yet keep the price of the technology low enough for people. Long story short, they nonetheless are still the second largest manufacturer and distributor of these lenses in the world, and the price is about $2 a lens. The next thing they did was, well, it's actually the first thing they did, but let's call it the next, is just-in-time approach, going back to this notion, which I'm sure is not dissimilar, where the doctor stands in one place at the surgery table and just does operation after operation, 80 a day. And then there's a whole army of very low-paid but well-trained people who do everything. And with another interesting conversation, from consulting people based on their ability to pay, and two-thirds pay zero or close to zero, yeah, as well as then taking them through in a very gentle and dignified way, what is going to happen to you? Things that I think we would really like to have to see in our health system. The next piece is the pricing model, which is bifurcated, so that in part it's choice and in part it's means tested. It's means tested in that you're talking to a consultant and they help you make a decision as to what your ability is. But it's in part, if you decide that you want to stay in an air-conditioned room, you really pay for those amenities, versus if you want to sleep on the floor, you don't. The next piece, which is distribution, and maybe we can talk about it because we have other investments in this area as well, and I think it goes back to Bill's original question, is telemedicine, using technology to extend a doctor's ability both to teach, consult, as well as ultimately to treat. But what's interesting in the Aravind case, and again, yeah, I feel like
you're experts on telemedicine too.
But I assume no matter what I say, I'm gonna know about this much compared to what you know. But is that if you, in terms of your distribution, your marketing, and your outreach model, based on who poor people are, and there's lessons for us in the United States, is that they will take their mobile van to do eye clinics, and they will do the testing right there. Well, if they find that someone looks like they have diabetes or a problem with their retina, they bring them right to the mobile van. The doctors at Aravind will look at it using telemedicine, and if, in fact, they have retinal disease, they will be driven right to the hospital, because what you'll find with poor people anywhere is that it's one thing to know what your condition is. It's another thing to get yourself back to the hospital to get it taken care of. And so it's building into the pricing, marketing, distribution, and design of delivering health to poor people based on who they are. And then for us, we would look at then, can we get a return on our capital? And for us, it's, we want our capital back over time. But more important, what is the effectiveness of that capital in terms of the number of people treated and the number of people that are healed?
Right. And let me take, that was a very rich set of comments. And let me just try to abstract some more general things from it. First of all, we were at a session last week here in Aspen, I think even in this room, or maybe another room, but there was a question of what is social entrepreneurship? And one image that struck me, one of the participants said, well, the old model of international aid is like blowing into a balloon. You keep puffing in, and the moment you stop, the balloon collapses. And I think that really describes a discredited model of foreign aid. And what you and others in social entrepreneurship are trying to do is infuse what people are doing around the world by giving self, trying to create self-sustaining models. You may start them, you may kickstart them. So that's one point. Second point that you made, and I think something that you might address also, is use of manpower. There are many ways to use people, but one of the things that we found in common in these hospitals, and Sachin, you might discuss it a little bit in just a second, is that many of these hospitals organize themselves like our military health system. We have in our country, and almost every country, a military health system which is in parallel with the civilian health service. In our military, we accept high school graduates delivering a lot of health care. They're very well trained. They're called medical corpsmen. And our soldiers owe their lives to these medical corpsmen who are on the scene, and they're not nurses and they're not doctors. They are high school graduates trained in procedures. We, as a civilian society, reject that for a variety of reasons. But if we could accept it like some of you, your hospitals are doing, we could save a lot of money. And that is one of the manpower utilizations that you talked about with Aravind. Mm-hmm. Another concept that you mentioned is innovation. These two gentlemen sitting here are not only cardiologists, they are extraordinary innovators. They are working with their advanced defense industry to create new devices for cardiology, new to the entire world, that may be more efficient. So innovation, whether it's innovation in sutures, innovation in lenses, innovation in surgical lasers like they're doing in Aravind, innovations especially designed where there's broad outreach health services are really important. Another issue is scale. I know you guys want to scale.
Yes.
You want to scale to other areas of medicine. You'd like to scale to other parts of India. How can you scale? So those are other issues. And finally, I can't even receive. You had so many different things here. Telemedicine is another really important part. Military uses telemedicine. You guys have a whole think tank on telemedicine. Aravind does telemedicine.
Yeah.
A lot of these guys do telemedicine. Let me...
Can I say one more point, though, and then I promise I will be completely quiet. The last point, though, I think about the social entrepreneur is that there's increasingly an unsentimental and market-driven rigor in what people are expecting. So that while there might be a spiritual component as to why we do this work in the first place, there's an unsentimentality.
Right.
And so
let's hear Dr. Somaraj's view, because over lunch he was very clear about that. This is the question of the economic viability. It's not only do-gooder, you have to be competitive economically. And you were talking about that as one of your key tenets of your activities.
So, but before I go to that, actually the model of high school graduates doing certain things in hospitals, I think this innovation was first from the U.S., the physician assistant concept.
Candy strippers.
And the nurse clinicians concept came from this country, actually. They stopped short of it and then never advanced beyond a point, and now we are using it at a different level.
Yeah.
So we learned from you, actually.
Good.
So then,
now we can learn from you how to really do it properly.
The question of... It's a sustainable model. That is the key issue in all this. Is we are permitted to do certain things in India which you American society and American system doesn't permit. Namely, number one, you can charge patients differently to different categories. Say we have categories like a general ward patient, a common ward patients, and sharing a room is shared, or a single room and a deluxe room, etc., and all that. So each one of them pays differently. The lowest category pays only cost to cost, and sometimes even that is subsidized. And then the highest category almost pays 3 times to 10 times the lowest cost patient. So in that situation, in other words, the rich are paying for the poor, and the rich are also paying for the sustainability of the whole model. So then,
but if you don't give good service, the rich aren't going to come.
Actually, we were just discussing that. It is in this model, there is an inbuilt safety of quality. In the sense, if you don't attract rich, you are not good quality. So in other words, you can't get away by delivering bad things to poor patients and still think that you can make money. So that's that works that way. But I believe in United States, you are not allowed to charge differently to different patients
right.
here, but that you have to work
on. That gets into the whole role of government in enabling these kinds of You have a comment?
Yeah. my thing is in terms of, because our model, we say that it is still evolving. It's innovation and evolution. The remaining thing that is still remaining with us is what is the accessibility, that means how we can deliver the same tertiary care or in the primary care in the current world. I mean, you have the technology with which you can leverage, and you have a set of people, which just now you mentioned, that we can train them from the villages, from the communities, to deliver health care through interfacing of the technology. That's where the telemedicine model that we are looking at. And we did work with a public-private partnership in terms of, because the government has created excellent infrastructure, but they don't have people to run it.
Right.
Or the, so what we did is, I mean, we interfaced with a government hospital, which we set up the equipment in terms of the CT scan and the echocardiograph, but we trained the local people as a technical staff. And then daily we do a CT scan from there.
Hmm.
We read from a hospital, and that CT scan cost about 300 rupees. That's about
$6.
$6 a CT scan.
How much did you pay for your last CT scan?
A CT $6. The machine cost similar to what it cost in the U.S. in dollar terms.
But the other thing that they do is they have such high volumes that they amortize their cost, and you buy, if I understand, high-end equipment, so it has a low marginal operating cost. A whole other theme that we could explore.
What we did is, in fact,
volume.
We partnered with the industry. The Siemens has set up the equipment. A software company has provided the software, and we provide the clinical skills.
So the
revenue that is generated in terms of this is shared by these three people.
Right. Sachin, you have Sachin has looked at this issue quite broadly and tried with CK to abstract some common principles, because you've looked at a number of hospitals
right.
and done some writing on this, so maybe you could
just
give
a couple
us some
of minutes
criticism.
To kind of abstract out what Jacqueline's already presented in I think very very succinctly about Arvind. It begins with the idea that you have tremendous unmet need. So what is an enormous challenge and a failure of the Indian medical system becomes an opportunity for a few. So what many of these models have done is, rather than having to target, you know, both for economical or moral reasons, if you want to change a million lives, you don't have to go after multiple specialties. You can change a million lives by sticking to one procedure. Cataracts alone, and if you just do cataracts, you can change a million lives. If you just do pediatric heart surgery, you're going to change many, many thousand lives. So it begins with the very high unmet need, and that allows these models to focus on just one niche specialization and reach both economically sustainable volumes as well as morally satisfying volumes. Now they take that ability to specialize, and then they take it further, and then they focus on it, and then they disaggregate the process. Let's say the process of cataract surgery, the process of pediatric health care, DOS procedure or ROS procedure. They take it and they slice it down to small pieces, and then they assess how to drive down the cost of every single step in the delivery process. This is where it begins. This is what specialization allows them to do. And then, you know, they do a number of things. They change their workflows so that people with lower skills can do them. They remanufacture the interoculars in Arvind, the sutures in Narayan Hrudayalaya. They take every step of this process and drive the cost down. And then they have, you know, and because they can use their highest cost resources, be it capital equipment or their surgeons, so spread over such a high volume, you know, they create a system which has very low cost per patient and requires a high volume to create high returns. And then that leads to the next step of this model. If you need a large number of patients, you can't just sit around and wait for patients to come. I mean, I could get into the social dynamics of rural India. People will not walk to accept care. So you need to then create outreach. Right? Outreach has at least three parts as I see it. Number one, you need to make your care affordable. It doesn't mean free. It means cross-subsidization. It means insurance schemes. It means partnering with government and funding agencies to get patients in. The second thing it means is real outreach, you know, telemedicine to take care where geographically it doesn't exist today, mobile vans, remote diagnostic units, you name it. Third thing, very important, is entitlement. I mean, Jacqueline spoke about the respect that Arvind doctors will give to the poorest person in the land. That's vital to create entitlement. Build it and they may not come. That's the truth of rural India. And so their outreach then drives volumes that brings patients to this very efficient, high-volume engine that they've created and delivers a large amount of care at very low costs. But one thing that I wanted to point out, which Jacqueline made an excellent point of, is that when you go into rural areas, Arvind goes into rural areas with cataract care, they might be the only medical provider of any kind who comes there. And it is their moral obligation not to sell cataracts as the solution for any ailment that a poor person comes with. So if they diagnose something that's not in their sweet spot, they need to take them away and get them referred elsewhere, and that's what Arvind will do. Very important, because otherwise that completely takes away the benefit that these models bring to society. Great examples, there's actually an NGO that provides reading glasses, and I went and visited one of their camps in rural India, and this NGO, you know, all it will do is test you for reading glasses, say yes, you need glasses, no, you don't need glasses, if yes, you need glasses, here's a subsidized pair of glasses for you. And there's several patients who come there who have backaches and headaches, okay, and they will pay the 30 or 40 rupees for the glasses because, you know, they've been told they need glasses, and they think that's going to cure their backache. But it's the moral responsibility of the NGO, or rather the provider, to make sure that they don't provide services that are not indicated by their own solution. So that's
there is a move, though, of some of these specialty hospitals, not Aravind, but certainly your hospital, Dr. Devi Shetty's hospital in Bangalore, which is also a major cardiac center, to expand services to other areas to see if this model can. Sort of what they're thinking about is having multi-specialty hospitals with some synergy through common diagnostic and training. I'd also like actually to recognize Dr. Michelle McMurray, who is the Aspen professional here, who is in health policy, who has helped us a lot in organizing these sessions, helped us in India with our session, and is going to provide a continuity for these programs. This, amongst others, are in her portfolio. She has a very, very broad set of responsibilities. Let me, before everything sounds too good and you're thinking that maybe this is the solution to all our problems, let's talk to Dr. Somaraju and Krishna Reddy about the problems you have now, the problems you see in maintaining, and problems you see in expanding what you're doing. Certainly, you can't live in a problem-free environment.
Yeah. I think the...
What are your major challenges?
Yeah, the two challenges that we envisage is in terms of, again, the reach out to the remote areas. The second challenge that we see is in terms of the human resource capital. The thing is, the society is rapidly changing within India. The major human resource is getting diverted. I mean, most of the children, they immediately think of a software company. So that means most of the talent pool is getting attracted to entity.
So the gold rush into software.
Yeah. So
not
so
into medicine.
The challenge becomes is how to attract the talent to the healthcare sector as a general. I mean, not just to our model, but as a general thing, in terms of a comparative financial support to them. Unless you give the comparable financial thing, they may not be motivated. So there is going to be a challenge in terms of rising cost on account of the human resource capital. The second challenge that we are trying to address, in fact, we have been interacting with the foundation as well, is in terms of taking the primary health care to the villages. Give an example, like the foundation, which has taken up about 150 villages consisting of about 1 million population, in terms of a social enterprise, targeting the education, sanitation, and healthcare, the primary healthcare. So we have been interfacing with them in terms of mapping out what is the heart disease risk in this population, which is not less than what the U.S. population, even in the rural India. So in terms of looking at the next best quality of, say, blood pressure treatment, giving drugs which are generics now, which are off patent but still as effective, is able to give a effective control of hypertension at a cost of 20 cents per month per person.
Gotcha.
20 cents per person per month. And the same thing, we are talking about a system here, like you talk about only a statistical benefit in terms of 1 in 1,000 saving or 1 in 100,000 difference between A drug which is off patent versus the B drug which is on patent. So the cost difference is enormous. You pay $10 for the treatment per day, whereas you are giving the same treatment at 20 cents per month per person. So this is the innovation that
we have. The benefit of an industry which is cutthroat competition in the generic business to drive costs down. I mean, you're right in the center of the manufacturer of most of the world's drugs. And there's cutthroat competition on cost for those generic drugs, and you're the beneficiaries. I think eventually all of us will be. If you're looking forward in the U.S. to lower medicine costs, you can thank what's going on in Hyderabad today because they are killing each other industrially to get more and more efficient to take a pill that's 25 cents and get it to 2 cents and still make money, which some of them do. And eventually, as they integrate forward, which they're doing, into the pill business, so they actually formulate pills, they'll be selling them to us. And you'll be able to buy even your generics at a fraction of the cost. But do you have a comment about what you see as the major challenges?
I think as Dr. Krishna Reddy already pointed out, it's not all that is a nice story and then everything is set and then runs well. We have problems. And these problems are number one.
Let me ask you a first question. Are you making money?
We are making money.
You're making money, so
yes.
You're not about to go broke.
No.
That's good. That's a very good basic line, bottom line there. So that's not your
problem. We are financially doing all right. And but the issues are like the basic problem with medicine today is number one, doctor's education. Today's doctor is not ready to take care of patients, manage hospitals, manage people and all that. We have some technical skills and we have some medical knowledge. That's how medical school is important.
Are you thinking of doctors in general or the way your Indian doctors are trained?
I'll say doctors in general and something more about Indian doctors.
Yeah.
See,
how did you guys
education?
Figure out to be such managers? I mean, when I've talked to you, you have a very keen grip. I don't think there's a book on management that you haven't read that's been published in the last 40 years. How did you guys get so adept at management?
I'll put it this way. Actually, there is an average medical graduate never is exposed to management principles. And the level of emotional intelligence amongst doctors is significantly low. And interpersonal skills and managing people is also another problem. We face it daily. And then an average doctor's pay, you may find a star cardiac surgeon or a cardiologist extremely busy, they make a lot of money. But rest of the doctors, they don't make a lot of money. So, and the nurses, the less we talk about it, the better. They are least paid in India particularly. And an average doctor and nursing, they take minimum 12 to 15 years to become somebody and start really earning money. And then an average IT professional just studied for 3 years and then he's making more money. So that is going to be a problem all over the world and we are also facing it. That's one issue. And the secret of our management skill is, I should say, the best way to manage a hospital appears to be put up with anything. Put up with all nonsense. Put up with any nonsense, and sometimes the nonsense is not from the other side, actually.
No, the best management skills we learn from the patient management.
Patient management.
I think the patient management gives you the whole skills required for a typical
medical. Do you have a program to help train doctors in mind? Is that a way you're planning to extend your activities?
Yes.
So you actually have an education reform.
Yeah, we are creating the infrastructure for the human capital. I mean, we are. Yeah. So in fact, our next expansion is that.
Medical education, as it's going to be, tomorrow's medical education should address all these things, management skills.
So you have a program in mind that you're in the process of developing to reform medical education.
Exactly.
So we could learn also. Maybe you'll tell us we also taught you, but we might learn how you've adapted what we've taught you. Sachin, do you have a comment here?
Yeah, I had one question and comment to Dr. Somaraju and Dr. Reddy. See, in the IT industry, and I have 7 years in IT, so I know that field well. I always think that the best educator in India is none of our government colleges or the IITs or all the names you hear about. It's actually an institution called NIIT. Now, NIIT I don't think there's an equivalent in the United States. It just gives you a diploma based on 6 months or 1 year of intense hands-on training. It gives you a diploma in computer sciences, which really is not equivalent to any form of university degrees. But it has the benefit of being completely market-aligned, in the sense that what you get taught is exactly what you need for the job. And my question to the two doctors would be, you know, is that a way forward for this medical industry, that, you know, can we create a more market-oriented training program? And number two, you know, as far as compensation goes, do you feel that if hospitals resembled more your hospitals than the government hospitals today, would compensation still be an issue? I think that's an important point to make, because I think that the changes in the medical models will actually drive solutions to some of the constraints that exist today.
See, considering what has to be done, number one, one of the bad things that is happening in India and surrounding countries is trying to just duplicate the US model. And that's not going to work for us. And it's going to be difficult, more and more difficulties. So we have to change a lot of things in the way we do, including medical education, including the delivery of care, etc. And while we do all this, the major issue apart from personnel will be finance costs for institutions. Finance costs for institutions, when we started our hospital, actually initially the interest rate from the bank was 24%. And now things have changed to 8% it came down. That's not too bad. The cost of financing is significant in medicine. With that degree of cost of financing, and you pay for the land, you pay for the building and all that, no medical institution is going to survive. And to make it profitable and sustainable, I think some advantage should come from infrastructural advantage on the governments, and also finance costs. Some advantages from financial institutions. The other day I heard of a nice name, angel investors, I believe. Mm-hmm. Angel investors means a lot of investors don't even look at medicine because their interest is only short term. But medicine will not get you short term returns. It gets you long term returns, provided you have a good model. I believe some investors they have a social...
Let me give you another new term. Yeah. Social entrepreneur investor.
Investor. Okay.
Of which we have one on the panel. And I think that's very important.
But let me say,
one of the things that you said is that the current copy of American model or U.S. model will not work in India. I think one of the things that attracts people here in this room is the model won't work here in the United States either. And so what we're seeking from, maybe from you or from others, is models that can work. Yes. And at least I'm personally hopeful, and I think Sachin from the work you've done and Jacqueline from the work you've done, there may be lessons that we can learn from you, hopefully adapt them through our own institutions, which are quite different from yours, to get a sustainable, affordable, high-quality healthcare system. One thing we haven't talked about is quality. And Sachin, you've looked at some of the quality measures. Can you talk about that a little bit? Because it would be self-serving for them to talk about quality.
Well, it's not, I don't have the numbers handy, and I'm not a medical professional, so I can't, interpret morbidity levels well enough. But clearly, none of these models compromise one percentage point on the quality of the outcomes that they deliver for
their
international quality, internationally benchmarked qualities for the kind of care that they provide their patients. You know, everything from the morbidity of their operations to the post-operative infection relapses, everything is as good or better as world standards. There is nothing sacrificed in terms of quality. It's
you had an
I think one, whether it is our model and modifications of this, we need to innovate further, there is no doubt about it. Whichever model we zero down to or come to some agreements, I think the secret lies in largeness of the model. It has to be not only in India, but also if we can try that out, In this country and all over the world.
How about China?
Everywhere you should try that.
I have to say that's one of John, Michael, and I's goals of having you here is to begin to get at an ideas festival some of these ideas out there, because I don't think the idea that you can get high quality health care that's sustainable for the poor and middle class in the developing world is an idea that is generally about. So if you want to say, is there an idea for this ideas festival? That's the idea we'd like to drive home. We'd like to see it adopted in South America, throughout India, throughout China, and then in the, I think probably unfortunately last for you and I in the developed world where we need it. But that is the hope that John Michael and I have with the work we're doing in the foundation. You had a question, Jeffrey?
I actually had a comment. Start going back to the angel investing and the notion of equity and health. But I also have a comment kind of on the dark side, because I think we're only looking at the positive. We have two equity investments in health companies in India. And one of the things that we've been talking about here are really important life-changing kinds of interventions. People get heart surgery when they're about to die. People who get cataract surgery go from being blind to getting sighted. What gets a big question as well that we have to ask ourselves as a world is on health prevention and the smaller things. And so there are different kinds of cross-subsidy models sometimes that occur within the marketplace itself, and it doesn't necessarily need subsidy. And another piece in that rural distribution that isn't for kind of catastrophic intervention is also related to quality, and that's that the drugs, and including the generic drugs in India, often are not trusted by people because they are of such poor quality. And I don't know the exact numbers. I think it's 50 or 60% of the drugs that people actually get access to at rural pharmacies are counterfeit drugs. So one of our investments is really taking on that that issue, and it's an urban pharmacy that essentially provides very high quality drugs at low price and builds a system of trust. We've used capital, in this case about $1.5 million of equity, to encourage this company to move into the rural areas and create a hub and spoke model. So they're not only bringing in trusted drugs, but then a clinician who can provide health services at that rural level. So it's a real experiment along the distribution lines. We think that we'll make money longer term, but it's another kind of model beyond the hospital model. And then the final example I'll give where we have an equity investment, which is looking at the health prevention and the health information side, is that particularly on, again, these non-catastrophic kinds of interventions, people typically don't want to pay for it. We don't either, if you think about how often we let our own health go until it's too late. And so this is an equity investment in a technology platform, essentially. And the idea, at first, it was a social entrepreneur, so he thought, I will deliver health information across India, and people will pay for it because it's so important, plus education. No one did. So we started looking around to see, well, what would people pay for? Very, very poor. Well, very, very poor Indians in rural areas will pay for their horoscope, will pay for matrimonials, looking for, you know, good Hindu boy meets good Hindu girl, e-governance, getting driver's license, getting land tenure, and photographs, photography. All of these are fairly high margin products and services that people will pay for. So what we're doing with this company, and now there are 1,000 telekiosks and we're trying to help them expand to 10,000, is to now start layering on top of this very profitable model the more public-oriented services of health and education, including distribution of some physical product. Because now that we've got 1,000, and there are 650,000 villages in India, to give you an idea of the scale, but now that we've got 1,000 to then start moving eyeglasses and things through so that your local entrepreneur can also offer it. So we've been having a conversation here about the more traditional health services that are incredibly important as a world, but to start thinking about health across the spectrum and where these interventions can really make change. And then measuring it is such a piece of what has to be done for the larger conversation.
Okay, we're drawing to a close now. Let me just make a couple of points. Remember that if you'd like to continue this discussion, all of us except Jacqueline will be here. Jacqueline very kindly agreed to join us. Let me just say, before you leave, don't leave, Elliot. I want you to get this.
Okay. Nothing like being known, Elliot.
and let me tell you why, Elliot, because you'll see. This is a program maybe for Aspen, for other issues. I think the issues that we've teased out here are really important, but we've just barely scratched the surface. There is no written account of these hospitals in any codified way. There are little specks here and there. The best work is done by C.K. Prahlad, one economist altogether working in this area. It is a badly understudied area. Let's just take some of the themes, and you just see chapters of books or books being written on this. I see it anyway as a former professor. I see PhD theses. I see a lot of stuff coming out of this. The whole concept of social entrepreneurship and what it means, self-sustainability, the balloon model we talked about. Manpower utilization, how you use manpower, how you scale. Something we barely touched the surface of. What is a government's role in social entrepreneurship? What are government policies, tax-free zones, incentives, insurance for this type of social entrepreneurship and other type of social? What is scalability? What is the use of telemedicine? These are just, how does research enter in it? What are the new technologies, information sciences that can be used to drive all this? These are very meaty topics that can be used to solve one of the world's greatest problems, i.e. providing high-quality health that's affordable for the rich and poor alike. So with that, we have about 15 minutes. We meet back here in a slightly different setting, and you'll have time to interact in a